So everybody got one of these. This is a word study. I don't know, have you guys, is anybody, are you guys familiar with word studies? What's that, Brian? So, we are not going to go through this in detail tonight. I'm just going to give an overview of a word study. This is very similar to what you would read in a commentary. You know, if you got an exegetical level commentary, sometimes there are going to be words in a book that are going to have these. At Dallas Seminary, the way that they do a lot of the language classes is you have to write a commentary on a portion of Scripture, and you're expected to be able to do these. You're expected to write word studies. And so what I've done is I've given an introduction to kind of what a word study is, how you do it, and then you'll notice there's a lot of pages, okay? These lot of pages that I printed off, this is every time that word is used in the book of Joshua. Every time the word avar, the Hebrew word, is used in Joshua. And so the process of doing a word study is you come across a word in the Bible. So this actually happened. That's why I did this. As I was preparing yesterday for this Bible study, I was reading through the Hebrew text, and I came across a word that looked like it was wrong. Like, I'm reading it, and I see avar there, and I thought, well, am I reading that wrong? Is there another sense to this word, another a homophone that I'm not familiar with? And I kept reading it, and I saw it twice, and I thought, well, that just doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense in context. So I looked it up on some of the software I have, and sure enough, I was right. I had the right word. But it was used strangely. So I thought, well, I wonder how often that word is used in Joshua. Is this a special word for Joshua? Well, turns out it is. Joshua uses this word 57 times, and the next closest person who uses this word is I think Deuteronomy uses it 48 times, and Deuteronomy is a much longer book. So it's disproportionately used often, and then there are, in the introduction, I give you a bunch of tests to see if a word might be worth doing a word study on. So you identify a word and you say, okay, could this be something that has a special meaning for the author? And then you go through, and if you want to do a serious word study, you look up every single time an author uses that word. And you read it, and you find out how the author uses it. And then you create, you look at the dictionary, which I've done. I've given you the dictionary meanings. And then you look at the nuances of the text, and you say, well, how is this author using that word? What are the senses in which the author is using it? So you notice I've given three main senses that the author of Joshua uses this word avar: to cross a boundary, to pass through a territory, or to violate or transgress some law. So the idea is that you are going past some kind of boundary, whether it be a literal or metaphorical boundary. Okay, and then you have thematic significance. How does this fit in with the themes that Joshua was using? And then I have a conclusion that says what the theological significance of this word is. And then in the footnotes at the bottom, there's a comparison of the Greek version of the Old Testament to see if there's anything there. And then also the New Testament use of the expression to pass over, which is there. Anyways, so that's, if you want some exposure in how word studies are done, this kind of walks you through the process. And hopefully, it may not be the most exciting reading in the world, but it was sure fun to write, and I mean that sincerely, and my wife can attest to that. And a lot of times in the Bible, those are those little nuggets you get, because you do a word study, and you think, well, this is a pretty routine verb. Why is this important to Joshua? Well, we're going to see that tonight. We're going to talk about this. So tonight, we are looking at Joshua chapter 5, verses 13 through 6. I think I said 6. 10, is that correct? I don't remember what I had written down. 6-7, okay, yeah. So everybody's familiar with the text. Would anybody be willing to read for us tonight? I know you guys are all good readers. Dan? Okay. How about you get us started, Dan, and then you pick the next reader whenever you get tired. All right. Yes, sir. Okay, so today, or at least this evening, at least all we're reading right now is this prelude portion, the portion where God meets with Joshua and gives him the instructions in how they're going to attack the city of Jericho. So let me just go ahead and ask, what do we know about Jericho? Let's take some our background knowledge. What do we know about Jericho? Yeah, it's a walled city, and it's fortified. And why is this significant? Yeah, it offered protection. Not all of them did. At this time in history, you'd have walled cities. A lot of them, some were, some weren't. What we do know about Jericho, at least archaeologists believe, that Jericho was actually probably a pretty small town. When we look at the sizes of ancient cities, like the city of David, I don't want to give a number, but it's surprisingly small. I think smaller than like 13 acres was the actual city of Jerusalem when David lived there. Now, there were a lot of people living in these outlying villages, but the walled city proper was very small because you think about it. If you have to build a wall around something, you're not going to build it big enough to enclose everything. You're just building a citadel, and you're trying to make it as small as really possible because the smaller you make it, the more effective archers and slingers and people like that are going to be, because a single man can defend a greater percentage of the wall, right? So having these huge wall cities wasn't the big thing. Jericho, they believe, was an outpost, that it was a walled city, and it was a city for that day, but it was mainly a military garrison that was meant to defend the inland of Canaan from external invasion. Because if you remember, the Israelites passed through, so giving a little bit of geography, at least from what contemporary people believe. So you've got Jericho, and Jericho is close to the river. You got the Jordan River. Now down here you have the Edomites, and then you also had the kingdom of Sihon, king of Heshbon, of Og, king of Bashan. You've got all of these potential enemies that are living there. So the Canaanite peoples that lived within Canaan, there's this outpost at Jericho, and this was probably meant as a defense against invaders who may want to come into the city, because anybody who knows anything about ancient military strategy, you can't just go around a fortified city, because the fastest you can go is on foot, and you can't leave an armed force behind you when you go in. Now you have to fight a battle on two fronts, so you had to take castles or fortresses as you went. You couldn't really afford to ignore them. So that's kind of what Jericho was. So yeah, you're right. There were not a lot of walled cities at the time, but there were some, and most of them were probably pretty small. What else do we know about Jericho? I mean, you guys have been going to church your whole lives. What do we know about Jericho? The wall came tumbling down, right? Everybody knows that. I mean, John Cougar Mellencamp sang a song about it. We all know the walls came tumbling down. That could be, I really don't know a lot about the walls, but I don't know the archaeological details. I know that probably. That wouldn't surprise me, especially if it were a small, heavily fortified city like that. I mean, this is before the age of any kind of significant siege warfare, of siege engines. The first mention, I think, in history of siege engines is in the Bible, where they talk about King, he was one of the good ones, but he was kind of a good one. I think it was King Uzziah. He also had another name. Uzziah was the king that had leprosy. Well, they said that he built machines that could hurl giant stones against fortifications. So whether there were other ones before him, we don't know, but I think that's the earliest attested siege machine in history. So, a heavily fortified city, your odds were try to scale the walls with overwhelming force, which would be hard if the ancient city was built on a hill or anything, had a moat or, any kind of common sense was used. Or you starve people out. Those are your two choices with a siege. And most people don't want to try to invade in a siege because your losses can be incredible. So, the fact that the walls just came tumbling down, that kind of makes it easy, right? It certainly saved a lot of time and trouble. So we've got that. What else do we know about Jericho? That could be. I would buy that. I don't. I haven't heard that, but I would say that that's totally reasonable. Okay. Oh, great. So yeah, again. Yeah, no, that's great. I've learned something. I know that. I mean, any city, any of the ancient cities in that part of the world would be some of the most ancient cities. Were you gonna say something? Oh, okay. I thought you had something to say, Jim. Okay, so we know these things, and what else do we know historically? Is this the first time Jericho has been mentioned in the Bible? Okay, where what else have we heard about Jericho? Yeah. Yeah, so Rahab the prostitute, the men go to visit Rahab the prostitute, and she hides them. I always like how how tender to our gentle sensibilities the Bible is with that one. You know, that's always been my favorite story is people say, well, God is so good, he was able to save the prostitute Rahab. It's like, what about the Israelite spies who were staying with the prostitute? It's believed that, yeah, she was a prostitute. Although some scholars, especially feminist scholars today, are saying that that's not necessarily the case. She may have been like the chief of hospitality in the... Well, if we want to turn it into a euphemism, okay. But the idea is that she was... That being the prostitute in a military garrison like that, especially one that would have been on a border, meant that she was probably an official spy for the king. Men or, you know, travelers would come, and she would get what information she could from them, and she would report. She would also report to the king about people who came and went through her home, because that's probably where they would go, and she would report. So the king had an idea of who was entering in through the gates of the city. And we know about Rahab. If you're interested, I can find you some resources on that, but it's just a way to have a good laugh sometimes. Anyways, so we've got that story, and we've got the idea that the Israelites have now crossed over the Jordan River. And it's interesting that we read chapter 5, it's not a coincidence that chapter 5 is right against chapter 6. The circumcision at Gilgal is very interesting. And also, notice where the circumcision of Gilgal is after they've crossed the Jordan. This is a strange thing. Now, if you're Joshua, you're a military commander. He's already a military commander. Joshua's probably pushing 80 at this point in his life. So he's not a spring chicken. He's been Moses' assistant since his youth. He's intelligent. He's capable. And he decides that they're going to completely cross the Jordan, entering enemy territory. Then they're going to circumcise. Not in the secure territory. And Jordan is at flood stage at this point. So you can't really just run back across if you need to. You're probably not running anywhere if you need to after you've been circumcised. They've entered enemy territory, and then it's like, hey, guys, I got a knife and a plan. You know, line up. Could we have done that back over that-a-way before we passed over the river? But they don't. So the Battle of Jericho, you've got the Israelites are vulnerable. They're entering enemy territory. They have not been tested in Canaan. And God comes to them, and Dan read for us this very enigmatic passage, verses 13 through 15. That's a weird thing. What's going on in verses 13 through 15? Yes. Isn't that true? What does that mean? I'm asking sincerely, what does that mean? Yeah. Well, it's funny you mention that because, go ahead, Dan. I believe it is. I believe this is the pre-incarnate Christ. Well, he was incarnate, but the pre-incarnational. Yeah, that word because there becomes really significant because
or I guess does maybe your text doesn't have because.
I but as commander, maybe because it's not in there. Maybe I'm thinking of a different passage. Neither, he replied, but as commander of the army of the Lord, I have now come. That's really a strange comment. It's not much of an explanation. I mean, going back to something that Brian mentioned, Dan, you kind of alluded to it too. Vernon McGee in his commentary, his Through the Bible on this, he believes that Joshua sees this guy with a drawn sword in the camp, and Joshua is the commander-in-chief of the nation, and why is there somebody walking around with a sword unsheathed within the camp? And Dr. McGee takes that, are you for us or for our enemy, as not a literal question, but he's saying, basically it's, hey, private, what are you doing with your sword unsheathed? Put that thing away. We're in camp. You know, this isn't time for fighting. But the Lord answers him in a much more literal way than Joshua's question was intended to be. So you can take it the way Dr. McGee does, where it's a figure of speech where he says, are you for us or for our enemies? Basically, put your sword away, son. But the Lord answers him in a way that he didn't expect, and he says, I'm not for either you or him. And kind of going with what Dan says, I'm for me. I'm the Lord Sabaoth, the Lord of hosts. I make the rules around here. As commander of the Lord, of the hosts of the armies of the Lord, I've come. And Joshua immediately falls face down. You got to give Joshua some credit there. You know, he's... But it's very strange. Because if we look here, we get instructions. I think chapter 6, right here, this is a bad chapter break. Because we would have a tendency to read this now verse, right? So Joshua is told by Christ, we'll just call him Christ because I believe that's who it is. Christ tells him, take off your sandals for the place where you're standing is holy ground. Chapter 6, now Jericho was tightly shut up by the Israelites. No one came in and no one came out, no one came in. Then the Lord said to Joshua, well, the question is, when did the Lord say this to Joshua? Are these two different events? Or are these the same event, where chapter 6, verse 2 is a continuation of the conversation going on in chapter 5, verse 15? Which way do you guys fall on this? Dan says neither. but it's go ahead. Were you going to say something, Jim? Okay. For my money, I think that chapter 6, this is just a bad chapter break. I think if we didn't have a big 6 in our Bibles right next to this, we would never question whether or not this was connected. And let me just check this to make sure, because I don't want to speak without knowledge. But chapter 6, verse 2, yeah. So there's a form, a verb form in Hebrew, called a preterite form. And the preterite is a lot, basically, if you wanted to translate it literally, it would be, and he did, and he did, and he did. So if you look at like a King James Bible, there will be a lot of and he somethings in the Bible. Newer translations try to read nuance into that. They try to fill in some of those ands into buts or thens. But, I mean, strictly speaking, it's the same verb form every time. It's this one is, you know, vayomar, vayomar, vayomar. It's one of the commonest words in the Bible. Like you learn to sight read that one really quick when you're learning Hebrew, vayomar. And it means, and he did. Now the idea is that when you have a preterite continues previous action. It's not when you have the and, that means it continues the previous action. So I would argue that this has to be connected. Now, why is this significant? Why is Joshua telling us that he has this weird encounter with the Lord of hosts, and then he gets instructions? Why are we being told this? Yeah, maybe the question was phrased poorly. What is the significance of telling the narrative the way that it's told? Now, obviously, it's told the way it is because it's factual. It's an accurate relation of the event. So I'm not questioning that part. But whoever wrote Joshua, whether it was Joshua or somebody else, could have simply summarized it and said, the Lord gave instruction to Joshua on how to conquer the city, and this is what they did. We don't have to have these details about the Lord appearing with a drawn sword, Joshua having this exchange with him, the Lord telling him, take off your sandals, this is holy ground, this strange interruption, at least it seems like a strange interruption, and then a continuation of the instructions. Why is the narrative told the way it is? I think that's an excellent point. I think that's certainly part of it. I think there are a lot of right answers to this. So yeah, that's definitely part of it. Why else? Okay, yeah, I like that. I hadn't thought about that, but I think that really sounds right. It isn't just this, you know, haphazard, hey, Josh, I think you ought to do this time. I mean, it's a very serious thing. The Israelites have been faithful. They've taken a risk. They've crossed the Jordan. They've circumcised themselves at Gilgal. They've rolled away the approach of Egypt. They're preparing to be and to do what God wants them to be and to do. And then we have this, like, quasi-confrontational meeting with the Lord. I mean, this isn't Moses and God sitting down and having tea in the tent. I mean, this is God shows up with a sword drawn. And Joshua, at first, doesn't know who he's talking to. This is a weird story, right? Like, no, yeah, I think that's a good point. I think that's definitely true. I guess what I'm getting at, and the question I was thinking about, the thought I was thinking about is, who else was told to take off his sandals? Moses was, and when was he told to take off his sandals? At the burning bush, and he was given what there? Not there. He was given the tablets of Sinai. Yeah, God gave him instructions to go back to Egypt, confront an enemy force, to confront Pharaoh, to speak the Lord's power, and to deliver the Israelites. And Joshua has an event that kind of mirrors that, where, again, God appears doing something unexpected, right? The burning bush that isn't consumed is an unexpected thing. Somebody walking around the camp with a drawn sword is not something you would expect. Brian, you were in the army. If somebody just walks around a base with a loaded gun, just kind of waving this, what are the MPs going to do? Right. I mean, walking around with a drawn sword would be a very similar thing. I mean, this is not normal behavior if somebody wants to keep their head. And Joshua, what you doing, friend? And God responds to him. So we've got unexpected event, the revelation that it's God speaking, this statement that where you're standing is holy ground, and there's a whole theology of holy ground. Maybe we'll talk about it tonight. I hope we'll have time to talk about it tonight, about it being holy ground. And then we get this strange statement in verse 6, which is a reminder to the people of where they are in the story that, hey, Jericho is this city that they need to take, and it's shut up. Nobody's coming in, nobody's going out. There's no chance of sneaking guards in and having them take the gates in the middle of the night and get some kind of siege. It's on. It's time for war. And then God gives him very clear instructions about what he's supposed to do. And these instructions, do they sound like they're going to work? Well, he told him it's going to work, yeah. But to Joshua, if you're Joshua's lieutenant, Boshua, right? Because he didn't have as cool of a name, so he didn't get to be in charge. If you're Boshua, do you actually think this is going to work? It does, right? You know, like, I never went to the Air War College, but I'm guessing at Army War College, you don't learn to just walk around something repeatedly, loudly, making yourself a target for people up on the wall. It seems like an unsound strategy. What was Moses' complaint when Yahweh told him to go back to Egypt? Pharaoh won't listen to me. Pharaoh won't listen to me. Thank you. Pharaoh won't listen to me. The people won't listen to me. I don't want to listen to me. I don't want to go. Just coming up with problems. Now, Joshua and Boshua, we don't see these criticisms of the plan here. Joshua does as he's told, but, I mean, we can kind of see the parallel here, right? Like, God's commands to Moses don't seem like they're going to work very well. God's commands to Joshua don't seem like they're going to work very well. If they work, it's only going to be because of what? Because of divine intervention. The only way Moses' plan works, where Moses shows up to a man who wants to kill him because he's an enemy of the state, the only way Moses' plan to go back and say, let my people go, the only way that works is if God shows up and divinely intervenes. The only way the plan to walk around Jericho and make the walls come a-tumbling down is if God intervenes. So somebody said it already. A couple people have kind of alluded to it. When they obeyed the Lord, they were making themselves dependent on God. God was going to get the glory for this. And I think that that's significant as well. God, I mean, the Israelites could have taken Jericho, especially if the city were as small as some scholars are now suggesting. It would have been a challenge. It would have been hard. But Israel could have taken it. I mean, if you've got an army of that size, a little city cannot survive forever. But they would have gotten the glory. And this way, God gets the glory. Other thoughts on the method that you guys have? Seven priests carrying seven trumpets. Now, I've always wondered, is it seven priests each carrying seven trumpets? And, you know, you get the, you know, you kind of do that. I don't know. But again, and the specificity, these aren't the silver trumpets that are meant to call the Israelites that were specially made by Bezalel and Aholiab. These are ram's horns. And it says specifically, I like your translation was very specific as I was reading this in the Hebrew text. It's very ram's horns. Over and over and over, ram's horns. I mean, these are incredibly specific details. I mean, did God need them to walk around? No, of course he didn't. You know what? You see, it's interesting that you interpret it that way, because to me, I think it would be terrifying. Here's this army that has crossed an ocean, who's dried up a river, who's destroyed Pharaoh and his army, so much that Rahab says the people's hearts were melting in fear. And then they don't brandish weapons, the men don't shout, the men just walk around your city in silence with these dudes in flowing robes carrying a golden box, blasting trumpets as loud as they can, and then they walk around your city, and then they just leave. I mean, maybe you're right. Maybe some of them are chuckling, and other guys are, what was that? And then you think of how many men, how long it would have taken to march around the city when you've got that big of an army. They weren't walking single file. I mean, it would have been simply impossible for the army to surround the city. I mean, they had to be surrounding the city for just a tremendous distance to be able to actually go around the city. I don't know. I have not checked the censuses and numbers. And again, the problem with the numbers, with the censuses, there are scholars who contend that those numbers are impossibly big, that there's no way that Israel could have supported a population that large. And the word for thousand in Hebrew, it's the word elef. And elef can mean thousand. It can also mean cattle, or some people contend that the word can mean a mighty man or a captain. And so when they say the thousands of each tribe, they're saying that these tribes were represented by 617 captains or 617 mighty men or whatever. I don't know. The size of Israel is something that people have debated for a long time, and I don't think that debate's going to go away, because it's not like we can go back in time and check it out. I tend to believe the big numbers. I tend to believe that they are literal, and they should not be taken as figurative. I don't think there's any reason to believe that. I also don't think that there's any reason to number the people based upon captains. I think that the handful of times where the Bible does that, the Bible is very clear that it's numbering people based upon representative captains, and that that's not a normal way of reckoning numbers. So probably we're looking at an army in the hundreds of thousands, in the high hundreds of thousands of able-bodied fighting men at this point, maybe 400,000 to 500,000 fighting men. That's a big number. They certainly would have turned the ground into mud with their sandals. So we've got that. And again, you don't have to take my word for it. There's a lot of scholarship on this. If you guys are interested in reading about the size of the Israelite armies, I am happy to dig some of that stuff up and try to get some articles for you that may be interesting reading that I think that'll give a fair treatment of it. But it's a question, and it's one that if we want to be serious about our Bible studying, we should take that question seriously, because that's something that people are saying. And it's a fair question. It really is. Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, you're absolutely right. And then that, we'll talk about it Sunday when we talk about Achan, but I'll probably steal that expression you just, I'll credit you. But I mean, it is. It should be a faith-building exercise, right? The fact that they verbatim followed Yahweh's instructions and Yahweh did what he said he was going to do by destroying the city, preserving the men. I don't think they lost a single fighting man when they took the city of Jericho. They should then have had the faith in Yahweh to honor the haram, the ban that he put on the city where no one was allowed to take any of the sacred items. The one should lead to the other. You're absolutely right. The one should lead to the other. This should build their faith. If they have enough faith to obey him, to do what he says actively, they should also listen to his prohibitions. The last thing I mentioned, I wanted to talk about it real quick. We're not going to get into any time. I know it's going to break your hearts. We're not going to have enough time to go into this. You can cry yourself to sleep later, I suppose. Why was the ground holy? What does that mean? I don't think we ever talked about it when we were talking about Moses. Holy ground. What does that mean? I agree with that 100%. It's because the Lord is there. But why do you have to take off your feet? Take off your feet. Maybe it's a prosthetic or something. Why do you have to take off your sandals when you're in the presence of the Lord? That is a great answer. I love that answer. Yeah. I'm not making fun of you. There are a lot of people I've met over the years at Bible studies, and that's kind of like, you know how like Sunday school kids say Jesus for the answer? Like you ask a hard question about why somebody, well, that was their culture. It's like, that's not an answer. Like, come on. But I think in this case, you're both absolutely right. There was something very cultural, and people have talked about, and I think that there's something to this, that you never entered a temple with shod feet. Never. Especially in some of the Canaanite religions. Now, just because the Canaanites did it doesn't mean that it necessarily equates to the cult of Yahweh. But there are footprints, like, you know how kind of we will press into concrete. There are markers for where people would put their feet as they would enter the temple. And they don't show, like, the outline of a sandal, of a shod foot. They show a barefoot entering the temple. So the belief is that people thought it would defile the temple to walk in sandals. And it makes sense. I mean, this is before public sanitation. Your bare feet are probably cleaner than your sandals. You know, if all your transportation is camel and donkey, it would probably defile the temple to bring the feces in. So what you're saying is absolutely right. You guys are both right. But it's not simply because it's the presence of the Lord. It's God is almost saying, and I think this isn't my thought. I forget where I first heard this from, but God is saying, wherever I am, that's the temple. You've built the tabernacle. The tabernacle is yonder. But my presence is here, so this is the temple. this is the tabernacle when I stand with you. That my presence is what matters. Not stones, not the curtains, not all the articles and the artifacts within the tabernacle. My presence is what makes a place holy and sacred. And I think, especially considering what Israel is going to go through in the future as we continue through Joshua, that's an important theme. So thank you, guys. Does anybody have any final comments before we wrap up tonight? I've heard people suggest that. That might be. I mean, honestly, God can use phenomena like that. I don't doubt it. Especially when you consider the kind of construction that they would have used. It most likely would not have been solid stone all the way through. It would have been an outer layer of stone filled in with rubble and dirt. So the wall would have been very strong compared to people with swords. But compared to earthquakes and things like that, it probably would have been significantly weaker than we would tend to think. But I think that's... I've always thought that was what happened, personally. That God initiated that. Maybe God exacerbated it, but God told him how to do it, if nothing else. I mean, God telling you how to do something scientific is no less a miracle than God just doing it himself, at least in my mind. But any other final thoughts before we close up? All right, thank you, guys. Thank you for a great Bible study, for all the participation. And yeah, take some of my wife's apple bread.